Okay, very good. So let me tell everybody what's going to be happening today. You are on the December Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. What's going to happen is in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing our speaker, who we're very excited to have, Dr. Kevin Trenberth. After his comments, hopefully there'll be time to get some questions from groups. There is time. We'll start in Scripps, and then we'll go down to Austin and Rhode Island, time depending. After that, we'll get some reports from the field, and it was, again, a pretty stunning month in terms of the amount and kinds of activities people generated. Included in those reports, last month there was a meeting at the American Enterprise Institute on the economics of carbon pricing, and there were quite a few Citizens Climate Lobby people there, and we'll get a full report on that. After that, we're going to get our this month's actions and our laser talks, so we have a full agenda. Before we get to all of that, though, I do want to especially welcome those groups that have had their group start since last month's session. So Santa Fe, New Mexico, Maria, what a fantastic group of people you brought down to Albuquerque, and Lisa, you know, the restart there with some new Albuquerque people was fantastic. I do have to say I agree with you that Albuquerque has the best huevos rancheros with green chili sauce in the history of mankind. Everybody that goes there should see Lisa for that. But then we went down to Austin with Susan, and Anna, what an amazing group of people, so wonderful there at the Friends Committee meeting, and that Ricky would bring a couple of people from Dallas, just in no way surprises. I just expect that Ricky's going to have the whole state of Dallas organized in almost no time at all. And then Madeline went down to Cincinnati, Chris and everybody. She said that the setting was such a beautiful place to start our first group in Ohio. And one thing that is really significant about the Cincinnati chapter is not just that we've got a solid group of people there, but at least one of the people lives in John Boehner's district, and that is really significant. So the fact that we can begin to build access to and develop a relationship with a speaker is really, really large. So our speaker today, Dr. Kevin Trenberth, was the lead author of the 1995, 2001, and 2007 scientific assessment of climate change for IPCC, and he shared in the 2007 Nobel Prize. Oh, whoever just came on, if you could star six your phone, you unmuted yourself accidentally. He's listed among top 20 authors with highest citations in all of geophysics. And one thing that I found particularly touching, Dr. Trenberth, was on one of the papers that you wrote on communicating on science. You honored Dr. Stephen Schneider in that paper. We were such a fan of his, and he was such a huge loss that we were touched by that and thought that he was also particularly important. I want to tell you just a little bit about the people who you're speaking with before you begin making your comments. You know, I think most people have been on this call, have been on airplanes before, and, you know, just before you take off, they make the announcement of, you know, here's where the exits are, and, you know, if we lose cabin pressure, the little thing's going to fall down from the ceiling. And as that announcement's being made, people are reading their book or introducing themselves to the person next to them or doing their last couple of emails. Or in my case, I'm such a nut about maps, I open the magazine every time and I look at the map and I think that's a great map. But nobody's paying attention to the announcement. The way that people listen on this call is as if that announcement was being made, but the person making the announcement said, the left wing's on fire, we're going to attempt a crash landing, and if you pay careful attention, there's a chance you'll survive. So I just want you to know there are no casual listeners on this call. The people are very intent in pulling what they need to pull from your comments to help solve the issue of global warming for our country and for the world. The other side, though, is that they're not grim, or they don't run around like crazy, frightened people. These are the happiest warriors I've ever met. One of our volunteers said this week she had a call with a former candidate for president of the United States, and they were having a discussion about what we're trying to do, put an effective pricing mechanism on carbon-based fuels and do it on an economy-wide basis. And he said, that's impossible. So she said, you know, before I started volunteering here, I would have thought, well, he's an expert, I'm not an expert, so if he says it's impossible, it must be. And he's an insider, and I'm not an insider, and so I must throw in the towel. But she said, you know, since I've taken on the view that I'm not going to be a cynical, step-away observer of my government, but rather someone who says, this is my democracy, this is my government, I have something to do about it, I was able to just include his comments with a lot of other people I talked to. And she said while she was respectful and took good notes and set up their next meeting, the thought that went by her mind when he said you could never get something that big done was, well, thank you for sharing. I'm glad you have opinion. A lot of people have opinions. So I want you to know that you're talking to people who are kind of a combination of very intently dedicated to solving the problem, but also being extremely enthusiastic about their dealings with members of Congress and the media and Parliament for that matter also. So, Dr. Trenberg, we've been following you both on your statements regarding global warming and extreme weather events. Also, your attempts to encourage the scientific community to be a little bit more direct in their own statements. So, welcome to the call. I want you to go ahead and feel comfortable to make whatever kind of opening remarks you'd like, and then hopefully we'll have time for some questions from the field also. But welcome.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It certainly sounds like a very nice group to speak to, and maybe I don't have to go into as much background detail as I might. You know, I thought I would start with an email that I received yesterday. This was from Gail McGovern, the American Red Cross, and a number of you may have received it. And, you know, of course, they're trying to raise funds, but it said, in my more than 4.5 years of the Red Cross, I'm no stranger to disasters, whether tornadoes, floods, earthquakes, or hurricanes. But what struck me about Hurricane Sandy was the massiveness of it, the miles and miles of devastation that just seemed endless. Boats lifted over homes, washing machines in the middle of the street, boxes, furniture, mementos, and precious memories of families piled up along the curb as far as the eye can see. I was also struck by the determination of individuals to start over, rebuild, and power through their loss. And then she went on to say that this has been a year of extraordinary events, and she named a few of them. I would add some more, actually. So there's the hurricanes. She mentioned tornadoes. You know, maybe that's really more last year. Wildfires. And then I would add drought, heat waves, and maybe heavy downpours. The West Coast right now is being deluged with some very heavy rains. So I want to talk a little bit about these things in the context of climate change and what the human component is to these. And of course, perhaps a summary of this overall, one which I often start with in talks that I give, is to use the analogy of the planet going to see a doctor, and the planet is running a fever. And so the symptoms are that the planet's temperature and also carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are increasing. The diagnosis is that human activities are causal. And then the prognosis, the outlook, is for more warming at rates that can be disruptive and will cause strife. And the treatment, then, is mitigation, which is sort of a code word for reducing emissions, and adaptation, planning for the consequences. And how you do those things is, of course, a key issue. So that's a quick summary from the standpoint of the planet going to see the doctor. Let me start by introducing the overall problem. You know, the fundamental problem is that the planet is warming, and the main cause is us, all of the humans and our activities. It's the emissions of carbon dioxide in particular. There are other greenhouse gases that are also important, but the main emissions come from the burning of fossil fuels, especially through things like coal-fired power plants, airplanes, and driving cars. And so if we look at the main sources, it's really fossil fuels. And if we look at the overall energy profile for the world, we can see that, I don't know exactly what the number is, but over 80-85% of the energy at the current time comes from fossil fuels of different kinds. And then the other components come from nuclear, and there's a little bit from hydro and biomass and renewables and things like that. And so if one looks at the profile of this, you'll see that there's been a remarkable increase after about World War II, and about half of the increase in carbon dioxide has occurred after the 1970s. The total increase in carbon dioxide since pre-industrial times, or since about 1900 actually, is about 40% of the pre-industrial levels, And as I say, excuse me, about half of that has been since about 1970. And so the rates are increasing in spite of things like the Kyoto Protocol, which is designed to actually reduce emissions. Instead, things are going in the other direction, and a big component of that recently, of course, is from the Chinese industrialization and also India. That's where the biggest expansion is occurring. But historically, the U.S. has been responsible for the biggest contributions. And so the planet is warming. We have the statement from the IPCC in 2007 global warming is unequivocal, essentially. There's no doubt whatsoever that the planet is warming. There's been arguments of different kinds that, you know, maybe it's not warming quite as much if you look at the global mean temperature in the last 5 to 8 years or something like that. But, you know, that's a red herring altogether, because the Arctic sea ice is at an all-time low, and the sea level keeps rising, and there are many other symptoms that the planet continues to warm. It just gets manifested in different ways. So one of the things which is not often realized is that warming in many respects might be thought of more as heating. The increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere really is heating up the planet, and one part of that goes to raising temperature. It raises the temperature of the atmosphere, the surface, the oceans, and that's certainly an important component. But if there's extra heat, a certain amount of that goes into evaporating moisture, and as long as there's moisture available, then actually more of the sunshine after a storm or the heat that's available when the sun comes out goes firstly into drying things out, and then the temperature tends to increase. So by drying things out, there are several consequences. Firstly, if conditions are dry, if we have drought conditions developing for whatever reason, they dry out quicker. The drought becomes more intense. It's longer lasting. It has bigger consequences. It greatly increases the risk of wildfire and heat waves, for that matter. But, of course, that drying has consequences. It puts moisture into the atmosphere, and the moisture has to go somewhere. It gets caught up in the water cycle, what we call the hydrological cycle. And so in places where it's raining, it actually rains harder. And it rains harder in particular because as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water vapor. And when we have a storm, it tends to reach out and grab the available moisture within the circulation scale of that storm. And typically for any storm, and this applies from everything from thunderstorms to extratropical snowstorms to hurricanes, the rain area that is occurring, the amount of moisture in the atmosphere and the area that is tapped for that is about 10 to 25 times the area in order to feed the amount of rain and snow that occurs. Or on a linear basis, it's sort of about a 3 to 5 times the radius of the rain region. And you can estimate that fairly readily simply by recognizing that evaporation rates are about 3 to 4 millimeters per day on average, and they don't vary a huge amount, whereas, you know, rainfall rates can easily be an inch a day, or in major deluges, 10 inches a day, something like that. And so there's a huge mismatch between the evaporation rates and the rainfall rates, which is why, of course, it doesn't rain everywhere at once. It only rains over about, the best estimate is about 7% of the planet at any one time. Over the oceans, it's more like 10%. But, of course, over deserts, it never rains. And the average on a global basis is about 7%. Well, 7% is 1/16. So, you know, the factor 16 is right in the middle. If you take the square root of 16, it gives you 4. And, you know, I was saying, 3 to 5 times the area. And that's a very simple number on a global basis that gives you a basis for that. And so one of the key things, which is often not recognized in conjunction with global warming, is that there is more moisture in the atmosphere. we can measure that. And on average nowadays, there's about a 4 to 5% increase in the moisture over the global oceans than there used to be prior to the 1970s. And so this is fuel for storms, especially hurricanes. It makes them more intense and a bit bigger. And it also means that the rainfalls are much greater. The overall estimate of the effect of climate change on storms of this nature is around about a 5 to 10% effect. And so you immediately get about a 5% effect simply from the increase in moisture in the atmosphere. But because that also makes the storms more intense and a bit bigger, you can get an up-doubling effect on that. And so that's where the sort of the 5 to 10% number comes from. And in many respects, you might think of it as a back-of-the-envelope calculation, but that's the order of magnitude of the climate change effect. And so when you have a storm, whether it's a hurricane or a major storm that is attacking the West Coast at the current time, it's easy to say that, well, 90 to 95% of this is weather. It's natural. It would have happened anyway. And there are some scientists who adopt that approach, and they say, oh, you know, the global warming component is very small. But the problem is that when we have weather events, whether it's the heat waves and the drought and the wildfires that occurred this summer, and which are continuing, I might add, or major storms like Superstorm Sandy, or, you know, earlier this summer, Hurricane Isaac, which produced prodigious amounts of rains in certain areas and caused major flooding. You know, all of these storms are already at the edge of natural variability. And by adding a 5 to 10% component, this is non-trivial, and it means that we break records. And that's what we've done this year, and hence Gail McGovern and the Red Cross's comments that in terms of the number of extremes and that we're seeing. And the other aspect of that, when we break records of this nature, is that I guess the parable is that you know, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. We go beyond the limits of previous experience, and things break. From a scientific standpoint, we call this, you know, things going nonlinear. The magnitude of the effects is much, much greater than the relatively modest increase in the rainfall that occurs. The case of Katrina, we estimated that in New Orleans, where they had about 11 inches of rain, that about 1 inch of rain was the result of global warming. So you might say, well, you know, 1 inch out of 11 or 12 or something like that, you know, it's not that much. But, you know, maybe that's the difference between the levee breaking in terms of all of the flooding that occurred and Lake Pontchartrain getting out over New Orleans. Or in the case of Superstorm Sandy, you know, this was a remarkable and pretty rare event in many respects. A hurricane that went through Jamaica as a Category 1 storm came up the East Coast and then combined with an extratropical storm that had dumped snow here in Colorado, and the whole thing became a so-called hybrid storm that was Category 1 in terms of wind speed, but the size of the hurricane force winds was just huge. And that had major consequences in many respects. It certainly amplified the storm surge, but the area that was affected was just so large. These kind of storms are fairly rare. They happen more commonly over in the Western Pacific, so they attack Japan, and these are the typhoons that sometimes go through the Philippines or into China. And I've experienced one myself, in fact, down in New Zealand. And so they certainly can happen, but they're not common. And another unique feature of Sandy was that it took a dogleg left and went right into the Jersey coast. Again, I think most of that probably would have happened anyway, and it just relates to the juxtaposition of the different weather systems and the fact there was a big anticyclone up to the north and a tremendous fetch of easterly winds as a result all the way across the Atlantic that had already piled up the water along the Atlantic coast by about 3 to 4 feet before the Sandy storm surge came along. And so then you have all of this stuff coming together, and what did the climate change aspect do to this? Well, you know, as I'm saying, it's maybe a 5 to 10% effect, but it's also on top of the fact that the sea level has risen and is currently rising at about a rate of a foot per century. And so sea level has gone up more than, you know, about 2.25 inches since we've been able to measure it from space in 1992. Using altimeters on satellites, and so we can now measure global sea level to millimeter accuracy. And so the higher sea level and then the storm surge and the heavy rains, all of this stuff came together to produce the devastation in the East Coast region. And one can speculate, you know, and it may well be possible that the subway tunnels and the tunnels to Brooklyn and to New Jersey from Manhattan may not have been flooded if without that extra component, that somewhat extra boost. And so I'm using this again to highlight the fact that a small change can, you know, cross thresholds, and things can go nonlinear and things can break, and so the damage becomes disproportional. You know, we're already this year, the outstanding event this year has been the major drought. It developed in the Southwest first with record nose snowfalls in the Rockies and especially the Colorado Rockies by about May 1st. And so all of the heat from the sun went into drying and then creating high temperatures. And so we had 5 days here in Denver over 100 degrees in late June, and associated with that in Colorado Springs and Fort Collins, there were major wildfires that burned over 600 houses. And then all of the heat waves spread, and the drought developed to the east, and it's had major consequences and huge costs associated with it. So all of the costs from Sandy and the costs of this damage this year, it's quite likely that a good chunk of that is associated with climate change. It's very, very hard to put concrete numbers on these things. But there's a cost to climate change. And so shouldn't the people who are causing this, the people who are putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, be paying for this in some fashion? This is part of the argument that seems to be lost when we talk about things like a carbon tax or putting a price on carbon. I mean, and the other aspect is the adaptation aspect. So how do we clean up the East Coast, build walls around the subway systems or along the coast and stabilize the coast, you know, getting ready for the next storm? Shouldn't that be covered by a special carbon tax of some kind? What about internationally? There's a clamor internationally from the developing countries and the poorer countries for the main countries that have caused this problem to set up a fund to support adaptation. And in fact, the Western countries, including the U.S., have generally supported some kind of a fund, but there's no money in that fund. It makes sense to me that that would also be coming from something like a carbon tax. But instead, the term carbon tax is bandied around and without having these strong links to, you know, why, and the fact that climate change has a cost, and preparing for climate change, if we are going to do adaptation for climate change, and you know, the alternative is to suffer the consequences, which is sort of the way we do things now, and we can see from this year that, you know, maybe this is not a very good strategy. So planning for climate change in the future has some costs attached to it, but the sensible planning can prevent enormous damages and costs that may occur in the future. I have maybe gone on long enough. I mean, we can talk a lot more about other recent major climate events, such as the tremendous heat waves and wildfires in Texas and Arizona last year, the tremendous flooding along the Mississippi River, the tornadoes that occurred last year, including the Joplin tornado. You know, the U.S. has certainly been suffering in the last couple of years, but the previous year it was the heat wave in Russia around Moscow with over 50,000 lives lost, and the flooding in Pakistan, over 300,000 people dislocated and many lives lost in that region, and flooding in India and China at the same time, and then the tremendous flooding that occurred in Australia late in 2010 into 2011, especially in Queensland. And, you know, there was so much rain in Australia in about a one-year period from mid-2010 to 2011 that sea level went down about 3 millimeters because of all of the rain that went into the middle of Australia in a great lake called Lake Eyre. And we can measure this. And now that water is going back into the oceans. But some remarkable consequences in other parts of the globe as well. So let me stop there. And,
yeah, let me if we can sneak a couple of questions in, okay? So let me first of all see if we can get to Scripps. Tristan, is that you, Tristan?
This is Danny.
Okay, go ahead, Danny.
Sure. My question is, I mean, I'm a scientist at Scripps, and I think a lot of people at CCL see Dr. James Hansen, and they see him both educating and advocating. And I would say he's definitely on the extreme. And it's been my experience that there is hesitance by a lot of scientists to advocate on the same level that they educate. So I was just wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how you see in the scientific community how scientists value advocacy and versus educating, and why some of them might be hesitant to advocate.
Yeah, there's two aspects to this. One of them is sort of set up by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and there are three parts to that. One deals with the science and the projections of climate change. One deals with the impacts and what might be done about those and adaptation issues. And the third one deals with the mitigation aspects, how we might stop the problem, and you know what the expectations would be if we took certain kinds of actions. The IPCC is deliberately not an advocacy group. It tries to inform, and collectively these three working groups together provide a tremendous amount of information on a sort of what-if basis. You know, if we did this, then we would expect this outcome and these consequences, something like that. And the goal is to be policy relevant, but not policy prescriptive. And from this standpoint, I think most scientists recognize that we have a role to play by putting forward this information about what is happening, what we expect to happen, and what we would expect to happen different if we took certain kinds of actions. But there are many other aspects that come into actually deciding policy. And, of course, I'm tempted to say, unfortunately, it's the politicians who are supposed to take all of these factors into account and help to make policy. And I'm not sure many politicians actually understand what their role is in this regard. But then, of course, scientists are also people, and they vote, and they can and should play an educational and advocacy role in certain ways. And the question is, can you do this in a way that doesn't compromise the objectivity of the science? And Jim, I think, has, in some sense, crossed that line. And I've tried to tread a little more carefully along that line. But I've certainly given a lot of talks and spoken out and tried to help educate. And at the same time, I'm not shy about saying that, you know, yes, I think we certainly need to put a price on carbon, but I haven't become as strong an advocate or as visible an advocate as Jim Hansen has. There's one other aspect to this, and this is the disinformation campaigns that have been carried out by often vested interests, oil companies and people with ideological bents against actions of this of any nature in dealing with climate change. And after 2009, after the debacle in Copenhagen, which was supposed to plan for how countries together would address climate change, there was this thing called ClimateGate. Fortunately, I was very much involved in about 300 of my emails were a part of the stolen emails that occurred. And I got a barrage of a huge amount of very vitriolic and very foul language emails criticizing me of different kinds. And now the experience is that if a scientist publishes a paper, and I've seen this happen with a number of young scientists, they think they've done a nice piece of work, it comes out and gets some visibility in Nature or Science magazine and gets some publicity, and the next thing they get a little barrage or maybe a big barrage of really nasty emails from a group of people that are orchestrated by some of these denier websites. And so the reaction of scientists is rather different, and unfortunately too many of them, I think, go back into the ivory tower is what I would say. In other words, they decide that becoming a little bit of a public figure, having 15 minutes of fame, was not a pleasant experience. And so the deniers in this respect have achieved their goal. Many scientists have withdrawn from the public arena and the advocacy at all because of this kind of effect. And so one of the things I might encourage you all is if you see a piece of work that is getting a bit of attention, especially whether it's a new young scientist, send them an encouraging email rather than it might help offset this kind of tendency. But, you know, 70%, I think, is the number. 70% of scientists are really not engaged in public education or advocacy in any shape or form.
That's interesting that you say that, Dr. Trenberg, because in a certain sense, we've kind of found that to be our role, both to be an advocate for mostly in the media and with politicians, because we think there's enough people who are trying to degrade the environment the politics happens in. So we do try and find people doing things right. And I love that all of our people across the U.S. and Canada will think, oh, okay, I'm going to start sending scientist notes about papers also. Let me see if I can squeeze in one more question from Austin. Austin, can you star six your phone and see? I think someone had a call there, Anna or Susan. Just it sometimes takes a sec to unmute. You have to star six to unmute. Well, while we're waiting for that, I'd like you to elaborate on one thing with the scientists, Dr. Trenberg. You talked about scientists making type 2 errors when they talk about science. And could you just elaborate what you mean by that when scientists are actually speaking about the science?
Yes. And so this relates to attribution. It relates to the question of how do we actually tie climate change to the climate change that we're observing or particular climate events? And the tendency in science is to set up what is called a null hypothesis, which says there is no human influence on climate, and we have to prove that there is. And the tendency then is to err on the side of not making a false attribution, and then the tendency is to make this to underestimate, I think, substantially the what is really happening with regard to the human effects on climate, and that is this type 2 error. having false positives versus false negatives. And it relates in the part and way in which statistics is performed. Statisticians require about a 1 in 20 chance that things will not be wrong in order to so this is a 5% level of significance, or a 95% confidence level is what statisticians refer to, before they will accept that some result is not just happening by chance. And so this kind of error occurs, especially with regard to events. And so the way in which I have argued this is that the best way to think about it is that the environment has really changed, that all storms are occurring in, and in fact they cannot be unaffected by climate change. And although there's always a large weather element or a natural variability element to these things, as I described earlier, this non-trivial component, but maybe 5 to 10% effect, is enough that it really matters, and that changes the odds that things will break. And so I've been trying to get scientists to talk about this in a different way. And in fact, I'm giving a paper on this next week at the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco.
Great, great. All right, Austin, were you able to unmute? I'm sorry if I was not able to include you. Okay, well, Dr. Treadberg, I don't know if you'll be able to stay on for the next part of our call. What we do is our volunteers are very active out there. They take the point of view that, in general, politicians don't create political will, they respond to it. So they're doing the kind of activities that create political will, that make it easier for members of Congress to ultimately vote the right way when there's a chance. So they spend a lot of time with members of Congress or Parliament and their staff. They get published frequently. They hold public events. So if you have a chance to stay on, it'd be great. Let me just say that how delighted we are to have you on the call. You know, different types of people have different heroes. You know, some people it's athletes, some people it's rock stars. For us, there's nothing better than climate scientists. So, you know, there's a certain rock, you know, I never got to see The Who live, but now we actually got to have Kevin Treadberg on the call. So that's pretty cool from our perspective. So thank you so much for making yourself available on this Saturday. We really appreciate it.
You're most welcome, and thank you very much. And I'll stay on for about 15 minutes.
Okay, fabulous. Okay, good. Well, we'll get the general reports from the field from Amy in just a minute, but I want to start with a couple of specific ones. We'll start with Erica in Washington, D.C. from the American Enterprise Institute briefing. And then after that, Tom, the Canadian group's had another successful invasion of awe. We want to hear about that from Tom. And then Kathy actually opened the Canadian World Headquarters and generated a lot of media. And then the last specific one is, you know, we've been doing some work trying to get meteorologists to speak up on this issue. And again, while this is completely perplexing to me, I don't understand why the public in general thinks that someone named Action Mike or Big Bob Weatherman should be trusted, but they're an extremely reliable source for a lot of people, and we've had some success recently, so we'll report on that. And then I think you'll all be excited to hear some of the overall results. So, Erica, can you start? Let's just see if you can unmute your phone by hitting star 6. Erica. This is the hardest part of the call sometimes. We're growing too big to deal with our conference call ability. Okay, we'll circle back to Erica in a second. Tom, how about you? Can you get your phone unmuted?
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Loud and clear, Tom.
Okay. So the first week of November, Climate Action Network Canada had its annual meeting. This is an umbrella group of 92 different organizations. And in Canada, they're a little bit different. We're a little bit different in that there are faith groups, labor, citizens organizations like Citizens for Public Justice and CCL, and sort of the usual suspects of NGOs like Environmental Defense and Greenpeace and so on. Besides the AGM, there was also some strategy sessions, and I think the key point out of that was, although the various groups have different campaigns and initiatives, the request and the desire was to make sure everybody includes the key points. The climate change is happening now, it's man-made, It's caused by fossil fuel extraction and use, and solutions are readily available at comparable cost to business as usual. So I guess they're good to know they're on board that way. Besides the meetings, there were also meetings on the Hill. There were 29 folks from different organizations who held a total of 28 meetings with MPs. That's Member of Parliament in Canada, and under the CAN umbrella. So in a typical team of four or five people, there'd be four or five different organizations represented. And besides that, there were also some additional meetings of CCL folks, three additional meetings with MPs and three with senators.
Great. Fantastic, Tom. So excited about that. Congratulations. Team Canada is building, you know, making regular trips to Ottawa besides making the visits in the local district and just building an enormous amount of support. Thank you for that. Erica, have you been able to unmute your phone? Okay, we'll try.
My computer froze at the most inopportune moment.
Okay, all right. Go ahead, Erica.
So on November 13th, the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, held an all-day multi-panel event at their D.C. headquarters called the Economics of Carbon Taxes. This event wasn't entirely out of the blue. AEI had hosted several earlier, quote-unquote, secret meetings on carbon taxes that were leaked to the press. But November's event was the largest and most public. Co-sponsors, the Brookings Institution, Resources for the Future, and the IMF contributed to the event. The meeting was packed with people. AEI wouldn't provide me with a head count, but I suspect there were at least 250 people there, many of them standing because there weren't enough chairs to go around. Mark and Marshall, along with five members from our D.C. chapter and one member, Bill, from our Richmond chapter, attended. Also among the crowd were representatives from NGOs like the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, as well as far-right think tanks, Heritage Foundation, and Competitive Enterprise Institute. We also had a chance to chat with Bob Inglis, a meet from Senator Cantwell's office, and Alexandra from Representative Waxman's office. The event wasn't about whether or not the U.S. should institute a carbon tax, but how you implement a carbon tax. All the economists and policy wonks on the panel started from the premise that a carbon tax is a good idea, perhaps the best idea for cutting emissions and fixing the tax code. I won't go into details on every panel, but the themes that stood out to me were the following. One, the debate about what to do with the carbon tax revenue is a hot one. CCL obviously supports a very progressive solution in the form of a dividend. A progressive tax is one that puts less burden on the poor. A regressive tax puts more burden on the poor. Most of the panelists would like the revenue to go to things like corporate, payroll, or income tax cuts, or in the midst of fiscal cliff discussions, a reduction to the deficit. CCL's voice in this discussion is critical since many of these economists seem more concerned about the policy's efficiency than the effects the carbon tax might have on the most vulnerable. Number two, Jack Calder from the IMF said the carbon tax is very easy and cheap to administer through the IRS. This is not a complicated policy tool unless you make it one by exempting certain industries or heaven forbid, throwing offsets into the mix, for example. And number three, while the crowd was really jazzed about the idea of a carbon tax, Obama's Treasury Department official, Gilbert Metcalf, who gave the luncheon keynote, reiterated the president's unwillingness to propose such a policy unless Republicans came forward first. Some say this is shrewd chess play. Others think it's Obama just exhibiting a continued lack of urgency about climate change. In any case, letting the president know we want him to lead on climate policy is very important. And to sum up, the event generated a lot of interest in the media, and I believe was the main reason a carbon tax has suddenly become a hot topic in the fiscal cliff discussion. CCL's 500 letters, op-eds, and other pieces published per year has also undoubtedly created an environment that's especially receptive to a carbon tax. Here in D.C., Johns Hopkins is planning another event on carbon taxes on December 6th. We just need to make sure that the momentum continues and that climate change mitigation is at the fore of such a discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Erica. Great report. Thank you so much. Kathy, you have the world headquarters opening for our Canadian office that was an in-kind donation from someone, and you generated a bunch of media from that. Can you tell us some of the media that got generated as part of the opening of the Canadian offices?
Hi, it's Kathy in Sudbury from the headquarters, and we actually have five people in here now. On our opening of our grand of the office here in Sudbury, I chose to be audacious, beautiful, and just way out there, and we got awesome media coverage. And I mean we because a whole bunch of Sudburyans were here. We were covered on the nightly news that night and on the front page of the Sudbury Star on the next day, a full-colored photo. It was awesome. That happened on November the 14th. And how we were audacious is we flash-mobbed out on the streets of downtown Sudbury, Jai Ho dancing, and then we handed out 3 Not Stupid Awards. The official certificates given to 3 citizens here in Sudbury, including the troop leader of the dance school that's been helping us flash mob Sudbury for the last 3.5 years. Someone, Mike Yanni, one of our citizen climate lobbyists who got me out of my comfort zone and helped me, well, pretty much spearheaded the very first fundraiser we ran here in Sudbury for Citizens Climate Lobby and got over $500 for that, and as well as the person who gave the in-kind donation to the office. But I didn't just give it to him. I give it to him and his wife because I didn't want him to keep holding up a Not Stupid sign to his wife every time they got in an argument, so they both shared the Not Stupid Award. And just one thing about our location, we are in the back end of a high-end men's store in downtown Sudbury, so the well-heeled in Sudbury walk by my office every day, and it's a giant glass window, and people can see all that we're up to. It's an awesome location, and I'm so grateful, and we could not have made this happen if it wasn't for everyone across Canada doing this work. We've caught the attention.
Fabulous, Kathy. You're going to get in trouble for having too much fun up there. You better watch it. All right. Great. Thanks so much, Sudbury. And Amy, we've had a lot of progress in San Diego with meteorologists, and in particular one that you've been working with. Can you give us a little bit of a report on what happened with Lauren and Caro?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. Yes, well, when we started out on this project, you know, across the country and in Canada, this early in September, the San Diego groups got together, and what we did was thought we would contact Lauren Nancaro for his advice. He's actually a local Fox News anchor, but he's been in the San Diego area for a long time. A lot of us have met him, and he has been a weather forecaster for many of the local stations. He brings up climate change as often as he can, and so we thought we could at least ask him his advice. So we reached out to him, but he didn't get back to us right away, and he really wasn't very upbeat about this. He said that 99% of TV reporters work on general assignment, and I think what that meant was they're just very, very pressed on time. They have extremely short segments that they do, and they have to produce up to 8 hours of news with little time to really get deep background. So he was really not that hopeful that the other stations would take interest. However, he did encourage us to keep sending him information because he's very interested in this and appreciated us being an extra set of eyes for him. Now, in the meantime, all of the other San Diego County Citizens Climate Lobby groups kept reaching out to stations and forecasters with calls and letters and emails. Our La Jolla group at Scripps was able to share the information. Their Scripps media contact, who can then connect news people to scientists, so that was something good we could pass along to our television contacts. And then also in September and October, there were 3 other stations who did very short segments on their weather forecasts. So we're very pleased with that. Now, in the meantime, we started noticing Lauren Nancaro's Facebook posts. On November 1st, he said, "I've been polite too long, you've been silent too long." And then on November 3rd, he said, "At some point, the debate needs to end and action must begin. Together is the only way we can block out the background noise and hear what's needed to begin the effort to turn things around." He also was very complimentary of his Fox News station and his boss. And then, lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, he announced on his Facebook page that Fox 5 has allowed him to focus on climate for the majority of their 10 o'clock news hour on Monday, November 19th. And that's exactly what he did. The majority of the news hour was all climate scientists, local, talking about local effects in San Diego, and, of course, a lot of the people from Scripps. And so we were just as pleased as could be. We also then immediately asked all of our folks to get on his Facebook page and like it, because the more we can give them report and say, hey, we really like what you're doing, the better. We got feedback from Forecast the Facts, and they said this is probably the strongest report they've ever seen issued on a local channel. And Jordan from Forecast the Facts said, the segment ends with the exact words we want every TV meteorologist to say. Global warming has local implications.
Great, 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 great. So we're seeing more pickup on this. Again, four stories in San Diego. We've had in Alaska, Texas, Portland. We're expecting big things from Philadelphia. So while it hasn't gone as fast as we like, certainly that we're starting to see some pickup in the activity of getting meteorologists to report. Again, that's a trusted source for most Americans, so let's keep up the work with that. Amy, so then let's just look at some of the general things that happened. You know, one of our gauges of how, what's happening out there is letters to the editor each month. And in January, we had 29 letters to the editor, right?
That's right, Mark. And then in February, we had 39. In March, 35. In April, 29. In May, 30. In June, 48. In July, 24. In August, a new world record, 58. In September, 43. We tied our world record again in October with 58. Mark, in November, we had 85. This is like a new universal world record.
Okay, so in addition to 85 letters to the editor, if you combine that with the editorials, op-eds, and articles, this is the first time we've had over 100 pieces published in one month, right?
That is correct. We went over 100 times being published.
Okay, good. So and I don't think anybody can underestimate the impact of that. You know, when Erica talked about the American Enterprise Institute, had a discussion not about whether a carbon tax, but how a carbon tax. I'm not saying we're the only factor on that, but getting 85 pieces out there in letters to the editor and over 100 pieces in front of people saying we have to put a price on carbon is really, really important, and maybe never more important than now, because there is a discussion of a carbon tax as part of a budget deal. If that happens, we're going to have to work very, very hard to make sure any additional revenues go back to households. Because one of the things that I think Dr. Hansen has accurately said for some time is that to get the price where we need to, which is over $100 a ton, people are going to have to see money coming back there to maintain support in the public. So this is just a really, really remarkable month. And you are creating huge problems for Amy, because one thing Amy's supposed to do every month is give me a list of groups that are supposed to be accentuated for their great achievement this month. But this month is, who are we supposed to not talk about? Austin, Madison, Toronto, York, your usual spectacular number of letters. Richmond and Raleigh, a great month. All of Oregon, Eugene, Portland, adding the new groups.
Oh, Mark, are you there? I'll just continue on for Mark. It was amazing. As I said, Eugene, Portland, great job. And in Canada, Canada just was outstanding. They had 21 face-to-face meetings with Parliament, 13 letters to the editor, a TV, radio hits, one editorial, an op-ed, 9 outreach, and 100 MPs, members of Parliament, signed the Climate Fast Pledge. So great job, Canada. Great job, everyone. What a wonderful month. Until
great.
Mark gets back
Amy,
on.
Amy, this is Kevin Trinbeth. I'm signing off now.
All right, thank you so much. We so appreciate your time on the call. Thanks again.
Hi.
Right,
can we have a question from Ottawa for Dr. Trinbeth? Quick question.
Real quick, it's important.
Can you hear me?
I think
yes.
You may have already.
Okay.
Oh, you're still there. Great.
Okay, so the question is you were talking quite a bit about extreme weather, but you never talked about sea ice in the Arctic. My research is showing me, my PhD research at University of Ottawa is showing that basically as the sea ice goes in the Arctic, that's the main reason the Arctic is warming that much more quickly. So with a rapidly warming Arctic, the temperature gradient between the Arctic and the equator decreases, which makes the jet streams slow down and go much wavier, and that's basically the root cause of the extreme weather that we're seeing. So as the sea ice further declines, in fact, if you look at the volume of sea ice over time, it could be gone within a few years.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And then that will further cause extreme weather to kind of take off. Are you looking at that sort of, are those connections?
Yes, we have some people at NCAR who look at that kind of thing. You know, the sea ice is extremely important, and there are local effects relating to the sort of thing that happens in the Great Lakes, the Great Lakes snow effect. So there can be snow in Siberia, and that has some consequences. But the farther field effects are less clear. It's not so clear that the Arctic sea ice has major global influences, and the mechanisms and the processes and the amount of heat that would be involved in order to drive the weather on a global basis to produce all of the things that you're talking about just doesn't add up at the current time.
Okay.
So it's certainly playing an important role. The role, I think, is more local, but exactly what the role is on a more global basis is a research topic.
Have you seen Frances's paper on...
Yes, I have. In fact, I'll be seeing her next week. And what she has shown is an association, but it's not causal. And exactly how the mechanism works is the key thing. And it relates to the fact that if the Arctic Ocean is causing the Arctic atmosphere to be warmer, then it takes heat out of the ocean. And in fact, that would cool off the ocean, and then the ice would start to come back. And so you should be able to measure that effect, the heating in the atmosphere, and we just don't see that at the moment. And so although the associations are there, it's not clear what the cause and effect is, and it may go in the other direction even.
Okay, well,
Dr. Trendis, thank you so much for staying on. I'm developing this bad habit of cutting myself off towards the end of the call, which is I'm going to have to correct with myself here. I'm really glad you stayed on so you could fill for us there. Steve, did you get a chance to do the laser talk in this month's action yet?
Yes, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Mark?
Yes. Yeah.
Great. Okay, so the two actions that we're doing for the month, first is to write letters to President Obama asking that he take the lead to address climate change in his second term by getting Congress to enact a revenue-neutral carbon fee. And handwritten letters sent through the U.S. mail are the best for this. And the second action is to get businesses, organizations, and communities of faith to sign on to CCL's new letter of support for a consumer-friendly carbon fee. Now, on that letter of support, if you get signatures on that letter of support, you can either send the signed letters or the information about the letter signers to me at steve.valk, V-A-L-K, at citizensclimatelobby.org. So getting back to the first action, writing letters to President Obama, our laser talk for this month is actually geared toward getting folks ready to write those letters. So here's the talk. In the wake of Superstorm Sandy, momentum is building to enact legislation that will put a fee on carbon that quickly reduces the greenhouse gas emissions that are heating up the earth. Surprisingly, three major oil companies, Exxon, Shell, and BP, have publicly voiced support for a fee on carbon. A statement signed by Shell and BP calls for, quote, putting a clear, transparent, and unambiguous price on carbon emissions. So, if oil companies are calling for a fee on carbon, what's stopping our government? We need a national policy that will put a steadily rising fee on carbon emissions, return the revenue from that fee to the public to offset higher energy costs that households have to pay, include border tariffs to protect American businesses from unfair competition from foreign countries. Making this happen will require leadership from the White House. President Obama can draw inspiration from the story of Lincoln, who overcame great political challenges at the end of the Civil War to pass the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. Like slavery, the issue of climate change is highly charged and bitterly divisive. But like slavery, climate change is an issue in search of a historic figure to lead our nation onto the right path, a path that would lead to a better world for future generations. President Obama must be that leader now. Mark, thank you.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Stephen. So there's a video link on the action sheet this month that shows the process the White House goes through every day of making sure the president reads 10 letters. We're hoping that somehow one of
of our letters get through, gets the president's attention, and certainly if you people, if everybody writes those letters, particularly handwritten before they leave the meeting today, and sends them, that will increase our chances of one of those actually getting on the president's desk. I want to say one thing about the Canadian action so that the Canadians clearly can see from looking at their action sheet that the actions are a little bit different, as is the laser talk this month. One of the things that Canadians have as an action, which I think would be useful for all of us, is seeing the movie Chasing Ice. Chasing Ice is a remarkable, stunning visual experience. But if you go to it and you invite people, one thing you should know is this is a very powerful message because they attached cameras to glaciers for 5 years, and you can't get away from what's happening. But the movie offers nothing in terms of solutions. So it's important if you take people, if you send people, let them know that there are solutions and you have something they can do about it, because if all they're left with that experience is, it can be a little bit debilitating. So it's already on the Canadian action sheet, but I would certainly encourage everybody in the U.S. to go see it, ask your movie house if it's not coming, because it is a very powerful experience. It gives people a very direct sense of what's happening. The other thing I want to say is starting in January, we're going to have two laser talks for every month as we want to build towards fluency in every component of climate change so that by the time we get to D.C. in June for our conference, we can speak to a lot of issues. So I'd like you to start planning ahead, that you'll plan a little bit more time either before the call or after the call to practice laser talks, because starting in January, we'll have one talk that's related to the action we're taking, but another talk that might be about jobs or economics or peer review, so that we all feel we have a greater fluency in every single piece of climate change. All right, everybody, amazing month, 100 pieces published. Let's see if we can keep that standard going. Thanks for everybody who contributed to the call and for all you're doing out there. Have a great, great month, and we'll all see you the first Saturday in January. Bye, everybody.
Bye.